Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD Radio. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. That's the toll-free. When you call in, press 1. We'll cue you into the show. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. And thank you, 87,000-plus listeners now, for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. Tonight we have an amazing woman, intelligent and beautiful, Mona Gable. She's a freelance writer in Los Angeles and the author of Blood Brother. This is a new book that she's come out, and it's Blood Brother, The Gene That Rocked My Family. And the book is available on shebooks.net and also I think on amazon.com. It's a very quick read, but it's very power-packed with accounts of her personal journey with Huntington's disease and about her brother, and more important facts about the disease. It's really a great read. You must read it. Mona Gable is a freelance writer based in Los Angeles. She is a contributing writer for Prevention. She is the author of the memoir, Blood Brother, as we spoke about, that was published in May 2014. She has worked and appeared in Los Angeles Magazine, Fast Company, Pacific Standard, Budget Travel, Salon, Ladies Home Journal, The Huffington Post, and other national publications. Since 1990, she has written about social issues, culture, and politics for the Los Angeles Times. In 2006, her story in the Los Angeles Times Sunday Magazine on domestic violence in LA's Korean-American community received a Nieman Notable Narrative mention. Amazing. Her essays have also appeared in several anthologies, including The Maternal is Political, Women Writers at the Intersection of Motherhood and Social Change, and Mothers Who Think, Tales of Real Life Parenthood. She was also a feminist editor of Blog Her, and from 2011 to 2013, the largest women's website in the country, where she covered women's issues, foreign affairs, and politics. And prior to that, for The Times, Gable was a West Coast correspondent for the Leisure and Arts section of the Wall Street Journal. She also began her career at San Francisco Magazine when she was hired as copy editor. And after attending the Stanford Publishing course, she also has a BA in Social Sciences from UC Berkeley. And she loves San Francisco, I hear. And we are so proud to have her on the show. Mona has also recently written an article titled Speaking Out About Living in Silence with an Incurable Disease, posted on August 3rd by the Sacramento Bee and also posted in Huntington's Post. And here we are with Mona tonight. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great, Melissa. Thanks for
You're
having me on the show.
Fascinating. You're a fascinating woman. I'm so proud to have you on the show.
That's really nice of you to say. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I got to meet you at Symposium this year. It was so awesome. But
that's right. I learned about your organization, and I saw the incredible lineup of speakers that you had, and a couple of those scientists, Jan Nolte and UC Davis, and also Ira Schulzen of the Huntington's Disease Study Group, were two people I had wanted to meet as a journalist researching Huntington's disease for a long time. So it was really a great opportunity for me just to come, show up and meet them and hear about what the work that they're doing right now.
Oh, isn't it amazing what they're doing? I, for 4 years I've been doing this show, and I've only met these wonderful people via the radio show and emailing back and forth. So it was my first time to meet everyone. It was mm-hmm. just surreal. It was the best time. And of course, the time went so fast.
Yes, right? It did.
Oh my gosh. But anyway, so you have been a journalist for 25 years.
Yes,
and I'd love
to
hear about your correspondent work that you did. And I actually went to your website today. Mona Gable is the website, and saw some of your photography work, too. You are talented.
Yes. Thank you.
Tell us
I love photography.
Gosh.
I've been doing that as a journalist for a long time, too, and I'm trying to do it more and more because in journalism, it's good if you have several skill sets these days, and you're able to take photographs and pictures and video, and that's something that I really enjoy doing, too.
So I kind of want to know how your past experience as a journalist and as a correspondent, how has this prepared you for facing Huntington's disease in your family?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question, Melissa. I grew up in a family that my father was a doctor. He was an old-fashioned general practitioner who went on house calls. And I was really fascinated by medicine because of him when I was growing up. And so when I became a journalist, I was always interested in writing about health and medicine and science. And one of the places I also worked was at UCLA Magazine, and I wrote a lot for the magazine about various scientists and diseases, and I wrote about research. I covered social issues. Several of the stories I wrote had to do with when the AIDS epidemic was just starting. And they were doing a lot of research at UCLA regarding the transmission of HIV, particularly from mothers to infants. Mm-hmm. So I ended up writing several stories about that. And I always seem to be drawn to these really tough medical problems,
wow.
And which I think is certainly helped prepare me when I found out we had HD all of a sudden in our family. Mm-hmm. And my mother also, when I was growing up, she was very sick. She had had a brain tumor and brain surgery. So when I was growing up, she had epilepsy, and it was something that I ended up writing about as well. Mm-hmm. So I've always been really fascinated by all of these medical issues and just always pursued writing about them. And so one of the ways that really helped me was when I found out that we had HD in our family, I knew resources I could immediately go to start researching the disease. I mean, there was also a lot of confusion about it for me because the gene cropped up in my family out of nowhere. Neither one of my parents had the gene. As far as we know, they had died a long time before. And it cropped up in my youngest brother in midlife. So it was really good that for me that I had not only this background in medicine and science journalism, but I also had sources and a lot of resources that I could tap into right away and try and educate myself.
That's the trick, isn't it, to try to find
yes.
the information to satisfy your need to know, you know.
Yes, yes. And in my case, it was very complicated, as most Huntington's cases seem to be in families. That's
yep.
an understatement, isn't it?
Right, yep.
Because my brother was actually dying of colon cancer when he was diagnosed with HD, there were people in our family who had suspected he might have Huntington's disease for a long, long time, but he was never tested until he actually was passing away. And so that was quite a shock to all of us that he actually had this disease, and then all of us suddenly had to face whether we might have it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm putting your website into the chat room right now for folks. The first couple tries I couldn't
sure.
get it right, but the second one I put your website so people can go and look at your accomplishments. Just amazing. So finding out that you had this disease, I mean, had you even heard of it before in your medical
You know, I actually had heard of it, but I really didn't know what it was. I had written about Alzheimer's, but just not a lot. But I was certainly aware of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, but Huntington's, I really didn't know what exactly it was, what kind of disease it was, and I just knew that it was some kind of brain disease, and that was incredibly debilitating. And I also knew that it had something to do with Woody Guthrie. That's about as much as
I
knew.
Right. Thank God for Woody Guthrie and Marjorie Guthrie.
Yes, thank goodness. Thank goodness for Woody Guthrie. But
right.
I think that points to the dilemma that so many Huntington's families confront with this disease, is because it is so hidden. And it is considered rare, although in my own research as a journalist, I've looked at studies in the United Kingdom and Canada, for instance, where they've actually studied the prevalence of HD, and the scientists studying it there believe that it's probably twice as high in those countries as reported. And there hasn't been a prevalence study here in the United States, so we don't really know what the real numbers are. And I think that's, you know, part of why it's so hidden. And also because it's a really tough disease to be around and to see, and to and because people lose their ability to work, and people really don't want other people to know that they have Huntington's in their family.
It's still kind of a closeted disease.
I think it really is. I think that's changing, though, which I think is really positive. I think among the younger generation, there's much more willingness to talk about it and
right.
to be open about it. There isn't as much, I mean, I think there's still a lot, of course, there's a lot of anxiety because there's no cure for this disease and there are no treatments to slow it. But I think we're turning a corner. I really do, in terms of the stigma. And I'm really, really happy to see that, because
mm-hmm.
I think that's the only way that that we're really going to make huge strides against the disease and really get the money that we need to develop research, you know, develop effective
mm-hmm.
treatments through research. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just saying that we need more education, more awareness. We need to
mm-hmm.
be educating the medical and psychiatric at the medical and psychiatric institutions.
Exactly.
Because there are,
are
still some physicians who are kind of refusing to diagnose until there's chorea. And what's unfortunate about that is not all of our HD individuals have chorea.
Exactly. And I think certainly that's a big part of the problem for families too, is that unless they're in an area where there's a really world-class, where there's really world-class medical care and health care, they may live in a community where their doctors have no idea what Huntington's disease is because they didn't study it, first of all, in medical school, and they've never seen it in their patients before. So that certainly mm-hmm. makes it difficult. But I do know that they're starting to, it's interesting, because I interview medical students, too, for different stories, and I'll often ask them, I'll say, have you heard of Huntington's disease? And most of them have now. And they're learning about these diseases in medical school. So I think that's incredibly exciting and promising. That's really a good sign.
We did have a study come out of Canada where, and I'm talking about prevalence now again. You
mm-hmm.
did mention in your article that, you know, it's really important that we know what the prevalence
right.
is. Because without it, you can't address the medical needs. And the
right.
social services that are needed, right? So
exactly.
The study,
and that's a whole other big part of the puzzle. Yeah.
Yes. So I can send you a link to. I had a guest on the show a year and a half ago. Her name was Claire, and she did a study in Canada where she found 1 in 7,000 individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
mm-hmm.
You know, a study is great, but not everybody makes it to these studies. So one of our medical advisors, Dr. Mary Edmondson out of North Carolina, she has HD Reach. She would be a really good one for you to connect with, too. She surveyed her state and found 6,000 people in her state.
That's amazing.
So now, based on that formula, I mean, we're looking at more than 300,000 in the U.S. Based on you know, population. Of course, there's going to be pockets here and pockets there. There's the founder effect, you know, where specific, you know, areas like in Venezuela where you have 1 in 10 there, you may have other pockets of populations where, you know, maybe 1 in 5,000 or something like that. But it's so interesting to me that through the survey work that she did, she was able to find 6,000 people in her state.
That is remarkable. How did she do the survey? Do you know?
I don't have the details on how she did the survey, but she is very proactive. She's a psychiatrist and a physician, medical doctor. And, you know, she has made a very, very concerted effort to find all of her Huntington's family. She runs support groups there and very, very active, very involved in finding her. And if we all could do that within our state, we could find our HD families and really help them, you know. And that's one of the reasons why registries are so important. You know, everybody has a registry, and it you know, we need registries. I mean, this isn't a very important thing to have, whether it's for medical or for just information. If you have a registry, you can really connect and feed them the information that they're looking for.
Exactly.
And you do that through surveys, you know.
Right. And I know that the when they were trying to find the HD gene, the search for the Huntington's gene, they relied very heavily on a registry in Indiana of families.
Oh, yes, that's true.
And that helped them, discover the gene. It wasn't just the families in Venezuela. It was also families in Indiana. So that's a really good point that you just made, Melissa.
And, I mean, ask any bride how important her registries are. She doesn't just have one. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, important stuff. But, yeah, talking about prevalence is really, I think, it's a very key important factor in trying to help our HD families. We have to know where
and
how many there are.
Right. Right. And in my case, for example, where the gene just cropped up out of nowhere, I mean, it's possible that my mother had the gene. She was an only child, and I don't have any living relatives through her line of the family, so there was no way to investigate whether I was really curious about that and trying to see if I could I could track it and trace it. And then my father's family, there are many people still living, but none of them has HD. So I asked several HD doctors about this when I was working on my book, because it was so everything I was reading, I didn't understand that it actually was the gene just cropped up in my family. And there's a small percentage I can't remember exactly what it is, but there's a small percentage of families where the gene just mutates and just appears. So it's possible that's what happened in my family.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's scary, right? Because you never know.
Yeah, and again, it also shows that, you know, that in terms of prevalence, some of the families probably aren't being counted. And aren't visible and aren't getting treatment, and we don't know about them. We don't know them because they're not part of the community necessarily.
Right. I would really strongly suggest people to find Mona's book called Blood Brother, and it really talks about a lot of your the trials and tribulations of deciding to test or not to test, and what's kind of what goes the whole mental psychological issues surrounding that. She really does explain all that really well. You kind of touch on it in your article too, but the book really goes into detail about your feelings and how you felt about even testing was so scary. And and you know, people need to realize before they test that, you know, it's a life changer for sure. It is if you don't test too, but gosh, you know, just be sure. You're not, I mean, what is your thought about that?
Well, in my case, I had teenage children when I found out that we had the gene in my family, that my brother had the gene, and that really was what made me decide to get tested, because I wanted to spare them the worry and the anxiety, and if I didn't have the gene, that meant they were fine. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of research. I talked to a lot of people even before. I pretty much decided that I was going to take the test pretty quickly because of my children. And I'm not sure I would have made that decision if I didn't have kids. Mm-hmm. I could have made an entirely different decision. I might not have wanted to know one way or the other. I'm also older. I'm in my late 50s. And I'm very healthy. And I had this confidence. Not always, but I was pretty confident that I didn't have the gene because I didn't have symptoms. Mm-hmm. But then again, I do know that people are developing HD late in life, the longer they live, and the symptoms sometimes don't show up until late in life. Mm-hmm. So, but I wanted to be sure that when I did take the test that I went through a testing center and went through genetic counseling because I just didn't want to go to my doctor and have it done. And I did have some struggles initially because I was going to go through my internist, and it was taking too long. Mm-hmm. And I was getting more and more anxious because I had decided that I really wanted to go ahead and take the test at that point. So I ended up actually getting tested at UCLA at their Huntington's Disease Excellence Center, and I had a really, really positive experience there. Mm-hmm. They really walked me through all my options, even the day that I was supposed to get my blood drawn, and as I was leaving the office, they said, if you decide that you changed your mind, it's okay, don't worry about it, just let us know so we can tell mm-hmm. the lab. And so, you know, yeah, I had an out. I always had an out. It wasn't like they were pushing me. I mean, I really, really appreciated their expertise and their sensitivity and the way they handled it. So anyone who can go to UCLA, I would just highly recommend you go there because I sent other family members there as well, and they also had a very, very positive experience. But it was terrifying. I mean, there's no question that it was terrifying, and it was something that I never imagined I would have to confront, having a fatal genetic disease in my family. And the thought that I could pass it on to my children was really, really tough. Mm-hmm. That was the hardest part for me, was thinking that I could pass it on to my kids. So, but it's funny because after I got my results too, even though, I mean, I was just absolutely, I mean, it was a very emotional day, of course. Right. I also had this part of me that felt guilty, and That was because of my brother. I felt like, well, why him? Why not me? Mm-hmm. And because he and I were very close, we were a year apart, mm-hmm. and we were really, really good friends. And our kids are the same ages, and we did a lot of things together, and we really were very, very close. So I had to kind of wrestle with that for a while, And but I'm grateful. I am grateful. I'm very, very grateful.
So you figured out you wanted
to
do some
writing.
You wanted to do some writing now about this, right?
Yes. And the reason that I really wanted to write about it was because I thought, you know, if I don't know about this disease, what are the chances that most people have never heard of it and are going to be confronting it? And I really felt like, I don't know, and this is part of being one of the reasons I became a journalist is because I feel like I have a responsibility as a journalist to get information out there. And to that's just something that's really, I'm really feel passionately about. So I thought, well, this has happened to me, and this happened to me for a reason, and maybe, you know, there's some good I can do as a result of this tragedy in my family. So that's how I tried to look at it. If I could help one other person avoid some of the trauma that we had, or just feel like I was giving them information that they needed in a very accessible way, rather than having to go through, you know, pages and pages of a website to read about Huntington's. If there was a way that I could help people learn about it, then I felt that I should do that, and that to do that.
You have a humanitarian spirit and a gift, and that's the two go together beautifully. So
what you're doing
is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's probably hard to write about your personal experience, isn't it? When you're used to writing about other subjects, it's probably a little bit more difficult to go inward and write about your own personal journey.
Yeah, it can be. It can be very difficult. I mean, I've done memoir writing before. I actually wrote a long piece for the Los Angeles Times Sunday Magazine about my mother and her brain surgery and growing up with her and what that was like. And I've done other first-person kinds of pieces. But this was particularly challenging because of all the privacy issues in my family, and I wanted to protect my family. I didn't want them to be angry at me either. And so I had to be very careful to respect their wishes and try and just write about my own story as much as possible. So that was the big challenge for me. And also just, I mean, reliving it too is always tough. It's tough reliving, as you know, losing a loved one, whether it's from a Huntington's disease or anything else.
Right.
And going through that grief process. But I also wanted to honor my brother and honor his life, and that's why that kept me going when I was writing, because I felt like he was kind of looking over my shoulder.
He was standing right there while you were writing.
I think he was.
On your shoulder.
and he had always been really supportive of my work. And always loved to talk about my stories, and he was a dentist, and so he would brag about me to his clients all the time. It was very sweet. It was very cute. And I wanted to honor him.
Yep. Beautiful thing to do. You know, you did touch a little bit in your article about the GINA Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, and you said it's supposed to protect you against discrimination. But what did you find out about that?
What in particular do you want to know?
I'm sorry, this is unscripted. Unfortunately, I didn't put the
No, that's okay.
This. But
the
GINA Act is a little bit confusing to me.
Yes, I think it is confusing.
Because I was under the impression that it is supposed to protect people from genetic discrimination. But then once you're tested, that changes.
That's not my understanding of the law, but I could be wrong about that, Melissa. My understanding is that if if you believe that you have been discriminated because of Huntington's disease or some other genetic disease, you have to be able to prove that it was because you have the disease. And that's a mm-hmm. very tough obstacle.
Yeah, it is.
Because how are you going to prove that? I mean, it's akin to, it's not exactly akin to this, but it reminds me of women having to prove that they've been sexually harassed.
Right.
I mean, unless you have documentation, unless you're keeping notes, unless you have phone conversations or something that indicate that you were fired or let go because you had a genetic disease, it's a very tough hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think a lot of families wonder if it really protects them too because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know there are a couple of states, and I think California, and please check this for me, I think California is one of a couple of states actually where GINA either doesn't fully apply or doesn't apply at all. But I would certainly want you to check that.
Yeah, and that's something you probably need to have a show about too.
That would be an excellent show to have. And to have attorneys maybe mm-hmm. who've dealt with this come on and talk about it too.
Definitely.
Any cases that have been brought, I would really be interested in hearing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that I kind of felt a sense of false protection when I got tested because maybe it's not a sense of false protection, but I did feel pretty secure when I got tested that my information would not go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then
and I was kind of assured that just because of the way that they assign you a number when you get tested, and it was when the counselors explained to me how my information is kept, it did make me feel more confident about my my privacy. But I don't know. I mean, that's a big question. That's a big issue.
It really is. I do know that insurance companies sell information. Some do. All the time.
Right.
I don't know how specific it is, but it's demographic information, you know?
Right.
And it would be kind of interesting to know exactly what goes out when they do that.
Right. Right. And I do know also that if you're trying to get long-term care insurance, if it's discovered that you have HD, then you can't get long-term care insurance, which is really, really a problem for families.
Right.
So all these things are issues that the Huntington's community, I know, they're putting a lot of effort toward, and I think it's really great. In addition to the issue that you brought up about nursing care and health care, having access to resources. Psychiatric care and everything. I mean, all sorts of people with mental illness really have faced a struggle with that of finding quality nursing care. And I
right.
think it would be really for Huntington's families, it's such a big struggle for them.
Well, and it's also a struggle to find good psychiatric care.
Yes, it is. It is.
And that's something that as I'm watching the groups on Facebook and the different groups that I belong to, I really take note to their struggles and trying to think of different show topics to try to help some of these
right.
struggling people that have questions. And a lot of them are based around psychiatric needs
mm-hmm.
or psychiatric management.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one. So that's
it is a big one.
Something I'm always looking out for is
yeah.
how can we help in that area. I think some of our centers are starting to look at the psychiatric a little bit stronger now, which
mm-hmm.
I'm really happy to know.
Mm-hmm.
That it's my opinion, but it seems from what I'm hearing and seeing in the community, it seems to be the first thing that kind of pops up is the mood, the psychiatric behaviors, and
mm-hmm.
the depression, the compulsivity,
right.
those seem to be kind of the first signs that kind of pick up their head, you know, say, hey, I need help.
Right. And I think they're very deceptive, too, because, I mean, if you don't know you have Huntington's in your family, like we didn't know, and the person that you love starts exhibiting these behaviors and you're trying to figure out what's wrong, it's very hard to, and they're resisting getting care. It's what can you do? I mean, you can't force someone to go get psychiatric care.
Right.
And I think there were some challenges with my brother there with some of his behavior.
A lot of different facets to this situation. What was kind of the aha moment for you, basically indicating, okay, I'm going to be an advocate. What? My dog's barking, sorry.
that's okay. Well, I heard there was going to be this, I was working on a magazine piece about about some of the research, the scientists working in Huntington's disease, and I heard that there was going to be an HD symposium celebrating the anniversary of finding the HD gene. And it was going to be in Washington, D.C., and Nancy Wexler and David Hausman of MIT and Marcy McDonald of Massachusetts General, all of whom were in the hunt for the gene and helped discover the gene, they were going to be speaking. So I was absolutely thrilled. I was going to go anyway just to hear them. And then it turned out there was going to be this advocacy day for the HD Parity Act.
Yeah.
And that's something I hadn't really heard about because as a journalist, you're really, you know, you keep that separation from advocacy and journalism. And so it's not something that is really something that journalists do is advocate because it's a conflict of interest, right? So in this case, I thought, well, I'm going to look into this. And I decided that I wanted to learn more about what the HD Parity Act was. And so I signed on with the California delegation to go meet with my representatives, my senator and my congressperson from California, and to tell them about Huntington's disease. And it was really fascinating because all three of the people that we met, all three of the politicians, representatives that we met, they actually weren't in Washington then, so these were their political staff members that we met with. All three of them had never heard of Huntington's disease that we met with. So that, to me, just showed how much work needs to be done.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in those rooms with these political officials, you have essentially 15 minutes to give them a pitch and to let them know, you know, what is your pitch? What is Huntington's disease? Why does it matter? What is the Parity Act? How will it correct, you know, these problems that Huntington's families are having getting disability benefits? And you have to explain this very quickly and very succinctly, and so it was really an education for me, and I'm really glad that I did it because I learned a lot. I learned a lot, and I also got to be with lots of Huntington's families, which was lovely. It was the first time that I'd really been. I mean, I'd been on a Huntington's disease walk with Leslie Thompson at UC Irvine because I was writing about her research. But I'd never been with so many Huntington's families in one place, and it was so inspiring.
Wow.
It was so uplifting because everybody had come to Washington from all over the country to talk to their senators and congresspeople about the HD Parity Act and to get them to sign on as co-sponsors. And you could see how diverse the Huntington's community is, too. I mean, rich, poor, all sorts of ethnicities and races and ages, and it was really something to see.
That's interesting. I have to say, Jane Cogan at HGSA has done a fabulous job with the Parity Act, and I am looking forward to seeing her follow through with all the work that she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I really am impressed with that.
Yeah, she was energetic, and she was great. Yeah, she actually was with my group at one point when we were visiting with my representative from Los Angeles, and she's just a dynamo. She's great.
Yeah.
And she really knows she really knows her stuff.
We need
and
to
clone
her.
And she's very committed. Yes. Yeah. You should have her on your show. She's wonderful.
I know. Well, she's been on my show.
Oh, has she? Sorry.
It's been a while. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
It's been a few years.
But that's such an important issue, too. I mean, making sure that families have access to benefits, because the time is so precious. And when you need that care and you need that help.
And the suffering is so great, too. You know?
And the suffering is so great, yes.
Without
and to
services.
Have to wait 2 years for benefits is crazy.
Ooh, yeah, that's too long.
Yeah.
So you've met some biggies in the HD world. You've met the workers, and man.
And they're
fantastic.
They're both amazing. And Alice Wexler, of course, who wrote a book about the search for the Huntington's gene, which is a wonderful book. For those of you listening in who haven't read it, it's a beautifully written book. It's a fascinating history of her family's experience with Huntington's disease and how they got involved in searching for the gene and founding the Huntington's the Hereditary Disease Foundation, which is their organization, right? I'm really privileged because I got to meet Alice here in Los Angeles and talk with her and interview her, and then I got to meet Nancy Wexler in Washington D.C. when she was there for the Huntington's the anniversary of finding the Huntington's gene.
Did we get pictures of you and the Wexlers together?
I don't think so.
Oh, darn.
No, I don't think so. I didn't even think about that.
I've posted your article on the Huntington's Post again because I know we have – don't do that. We have – excuse me just for a moment. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I've actually put their books on your Huntington's Post page, Mapping Fate and The Gene Hunter.
Yes.
I thought maybe people
great.
Might be interested after hearing the show and being able to see those books. And, of course, your book, Blood Brothers, on there as well. You can get Mona's book at Amazon.com or SheBooks. And I've put those links on the website, on Huntington's Post link as well for you.
That's really generous of you.
Well, we're trying to get as much information out as possible in any and every way possible. So, you know. But so tell us, what is next for you? What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm working on a bigger book on Huntington's disease. So that's really exciting, and it's going to be a lot about some of the research that's going on in different laboratories around the country, talk about some of these remarkable scientists who are so committed to finding treatments and a cure for Huntington's. I mean, that's one of the things that I have to say, you know, having written about various kinds of science and medicine and meeting all kinds of scientists. I'm really impressed by how closely the scientists in Huntington's disease work with the families. It's really interesting. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
They're very close to the families, and they really are just absolutely committed to this disease in ways not that other scientists aren't to their diseases, but there is something special about it. There really is. And maybe in part because it's a disease that is so it's so devastating to families. And
it's generational.
And it's generational, and it just keeps going. And I mean, there are certainly other diseases that have that aspect too, but not in the way that Huntington's does, where it's 50-50.
Right.
And where families often don't even know that that the disease is in their family, and they go ahead and have children and then find out their kids have it. Mm-hmm. And that's just really, really devastating. So I'm really excited about the opportunity of, you know, spending more time with the scientists, and also I'll also be writing about some family stories and the history of Huntington's disease, and so we'll see where that goes.
Well, may I make a suggestion, because you know, I started the radio show in 2010, and now with 186 or 7 shows, each one represents someone who has said yes to come on the show and tell me what they're doing, tell the community what they're doing. And a lot of them are research scientists. And look at the list and see who you might be interested in talking with. We can collaborate and connect with each other and see how we can get your book on the road.
That's a great suggestion. Thanks.
And you're right. Every single one of the researchers, scientists that I've asked to come on this show, they've all said yes. Even the ones who maybe aren't dedicating 100% of their time to Huntington, they've all said yes.
Mm-hmm.
To me. They're doing what they're doing for a reason. They want to
right.
help. They want to find, you know, treatments or the cure, and they're dedicating their entire careers to us and to other disease categories that, you know, need help.
Right, and they're a very close-knit scientific community, too, which is really interesting. They all know each other. They all go to the same conferences. They share research, which is very unusual in science, and they're collaborative, and they're kind of carrying on that kind of collaborative spirit that helped discover the gene. So I really have a lot of optimism about their ability to find treatments for Huntington's because of their commitment, but also because of the way they're actually working together. And that's going to really push forward the research.
Fantastic. Well, I'm just so amazed at what you're doing. I want you to keep going. Don't stop. Keep writing.
I'll try.
Share with us what you're doing. It's fantastic. And I'm glad you're out there working away.
Thank
trying
you.
To get the information to our families. Did we forget anything? Is there anything else we wanted to talk about today?
I don't think so.
Okay. Are you doing any book signings or anything like that anywhere?
Well, I'm doing another radio show actually next week.
Oh, okay.
Which is really going to be fun. It's for a show called Virtually Speaking Science.
Oh,
and
cool.
It's online, it's conducted by a woman who's actually a bioethicist, Kelly Hills, and she's going to be interviewing me and another journalist who has a really fantastic story out in Pacific Standard magazine right now about this genetic project, that DNA project that's happening in North Carolina, taking hundreds of people's DNA. So it involves a lot of ethical questions, but so that's going to be on next Tuesday at 5 o'clock Pacific time and 8 o'clock East Coast time. But another thing they do is they have an audience that comes into the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and these are regular people who listen to the show all the time, and so they submit questions online, and then we get to answer questions. So I'm really excited about that.
Cool.
And I'm doing some readings in LA right now. I'm doing a reading in October in Los Angeles with three other She Books authors.
Okay.
And so that'll be really fun.
You did one in May.
That.
You did signing in May.
Yeah. Right.
How'd that go?
So it went great. It was really exciting. Yeah,
cool.
We had a terrific turnout and lots of different, you know, authors read, and it was really a fun event.
That's great. Well, listen, we'll go ahead and do some announcements, upcoming shows, and I just want to thank you again, Mona, for doing what you're doing and for coming on the show and sharing with us. It's so exciting to hear what you're doing. And keep going.
Well, thank you for having me on, Melissa.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for doing everything that you do.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You're welcome.
Okay.
Keep working together.
All right.
Yep. Help each other.
Bye-bye.
You don't need to hang up unless you need to. But, we have upcoming shows. Next Tuesday, we're either going to have Teva Pharmaceuticals on or Carla Muller, A Place for Mom. We had a little double booking happening, so we'll I'm not sure which is going to be, but next week we'll have a really good show. On 9/2, we'll have Dr. Goodman, Ask Dr. Goodman again. On September 9th, we have Chef Dennis Thierre. He's cooking for feeding tubes. This is a very interesting topic.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And September 16th, Dr. Speed, Lorena Speed, will be back on. We're talking about clinical trials. She's written a book. And and she's a fantastic technical, more of a technical type of a writer about clinical trials. And we'll be talking about the PIs, what's in the side of the head of the PI, the person who's conducting the clinical trials. Why is he doing
right.
he or she? What is the process to go through and to get these clinical trials going? And how do they enroll and retain their subjects? They are dedicated and devoted people, you know, medical doctors, sometimes medical doctors, sometimes, you know, PhDs, but they're really trying to help us, and we want to help them too. So we're going to figure out what they're doing and why they're doing it so that we can understand what we can do to help them too. And then on September 30th, Kristen Powers, you may have met her.
I know Kristen.
Yeah,
she was in Washington, too, with me. Uh-huh.
That's what I thought, too. She's going to be
That's
on
where I met
September
her.
30th. Uh-huh. Yeah. Cute gal. She's with Hopes right now, Stanford Hopes. They were at the symposium,
right.
at our symposium. And, man, she is just a go-getter. So she's going to be
she
on
is.
Talk About Switch. She's trying to raise funds to get her documentary out on the road. You know, documentaries take a lot of money, so we need to help her as well. And then announcements that I have today, we had Thicket products donated to us by the company. And for those folks out there that need to thicken their liquids for choking purposes, please email me at melissa@helpforhd.org. I have free product. I'll send it out to you. And it will not cost you a thing, and I will send it out as long as I have product to send. And I just sent a box. I put it in the mailers, the flat rate mailer boxes, the large flat rate box, and you can get quite a bit of product in there. And it's pretty darn heavy, so be sure and let me know if you need some Thicket products. And that's about it for tonight. And again, Mona, you're a sweetheart. Thank you so much for coming on. And
thank you, Melissa, for having me.
Back and listen to the on-demand episodes. Here's my spiel. Don't forget to tell your family, friends, and colleagues about Help for HD Radio and find us on Facebook, Help for HD, or helpforhd.org. And y'all have a great night. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Mona. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.